As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time now for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Mike Delavante, guitar player in the Delavantes, whose lineup also includes his brother Bob. And they began the band in New Jersey in the late 1980s, relocating to Nashville, Tennessee in the early 90s. During the decade, they released a couple of albums that were very well received by the burgeoning Americana scene. Then they took a hiatus, and they're back now with a new album called A Thousand Turns, which features our recent coolest song in the world, All in All. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Mike on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Stars glow in a pitch black sky. Big old moon. Shimmers across the deep blue sea, drowning, drowning you and me. There was a time I did not know, and the night hung deep and low. I'd no idea that there could be all in all, yeah, you and me. All in all, you and me, yeah, all in all, and all that's so big.
It's Coolest Conversations time here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and I've got Mike Delavante from the Delavantes with me today. He and his brother Bob formed a group back in the late 80s in Hoboken, New Jersey, later relocated to Nashville, Tennessee. How are you, Mike?
I'm well. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me again here. Want to make sure that you and your brother, family and friends in general, have you guys been able to stay healthy over the past year and a half?
You know, we've all been pretty good. Yeah, everybody's been healthy. No issues over here. We've just been locked up in our little studios.
Then it's been a fertile and creative time.
It has. In fact, we pretty much just finished the basic tracks for this record and then started to do overdubs. And then the pandemic hit, so we had to sort of figure out how we were going to move forward with it. And so, you know, Bob has a studio behind his house. I have a little converted garage here at my house, and taught myself enough Pro Tools to be dangerous, and worked with our mixing our mix master, the gentleman that mixed the record, a guy named Bill Schnee, and we worked together. And I did the guitars here at my studio, and we just did it the new fashioned way through email. And I think, you know, it was a great time to have that we had a lot of extra time, so. It was just a different process for this record than other records we've done. So
I'm sure it must have been, you know, you guys got back together 2019, then the pandemic hits in 2020. Man, I would think that would be really discouraging that finally you're sort of back doing the thing and then you're having to take everything's getting shut down again. But it seems like you guys weathered that pretty well, right?
I think we did. I think the biggest thing that really affected our friends in this world is not being able to go and play live. And at the time, we didn't really think we were going to play much live anyway, since we'd be working on the record. And we just had to rethink the way we were going to approach finishing this record. And we just kind of thought about that from the standpoint of how do we get together and listen to things, make some, you know, get some ideas together. And then they record them separately and then pull them together. But, you know, really when it comes down to it, you know, 80%, 75% of the record was done right before the pandemic. So being in a studio here in town, we were at Blackbird studios, great studio here in town. Recorded the basic tracks with Gary Talent, who co-produced and played bass, and a longtime friend drummer of ours, Brian Owings, played drums. And just the four of us went in there for 2 weeks and recorded 14 songs.
You know, Don Everly passed away just a couple of weeks back, and before I found any like bio on you guys or listened to the older albums, so some tracks off there, I checked out the new record, A Thousand Turns, and I was listening. I was going, oh, well, there's some close harmony things going on there, some songs more pronounced than others. I'm going to ask Mike about Don's passing and, you know, how relevant the Everlys were to them, what type of influences. And then I sort of read up on the bios and saw the reviews of the older albums, and it's, you know, they're always name checking the Everly brothers. So obviously that's something that you've been asked before, and it's something that seems present to varying degrees, depending on the song in your music. Still though, Don has passed. Do you mind talking about the Everlys and Don, or how much of an impact that close harmony singing had to you guys when you were developing your own sound?
Sure. I mean, I think the Everlys were incredibly important to a whole host of genres and styles. The vocals, of course, but the songs and the arrangements. I mean, that was just, they were, some people wrote, there wouldn't have been a Beatles if there weren't the Everlys. And, you know, I think that John and Paul wanted to be Don and Phil, and they've said that, you know. So they were incredibly important that way. And they were one of those bands that, you know, or musicians that cut through to what I would, you know, AM radio, and growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, you know, it had to be a pretty big hit to kind of cut through. And, you know, but they were one of those, you know, they were like, their hits were, you know, were massive. They weren't, it wasn't just that they were a country act, or, I mean, they crossed over into all different genres. So we heard them all the time. They were very important. But I would say that what really hit me about Brother Harmonies was I had a class in college, and it was called The History of Rock and Roll. And it was a great, got off easy on that one, but that was, it was one of my, you know, one of my classes. The instructor took out an album and put down the needle onto the Louvin brothers, and they started singing this song called Make Me a Soldier. And the vocal harmonies and the overlaps of how they intertwine their voices just like hit me, you know, like a hammer on the head. And I thought, this is just amazing. And then I did my, you know, did digging around and realized that the Everlys were fans of those. And it's just all these brother harmony groups that started in bluegrass gospel. And just researching all that led me to even appreciate the Everlys more. So, you know, this is a Nashville story, but I got a chance to meet Phil very briefly, because this is the Nashville story. His grandson went to school with my nephew. So we're at graduation, and there's, you know, and the grandson's like, hey, you want to meet my grandfather? And we're like, yes, we do. And so, you know, that's just such a typical Nashville story. Everybody's sort of, you know, there's so many people walking around that are in this business, and you see them in, you know, all different walks of life.
Right. I'm sure you can't swing a guitar there in town without clobbering some musician upside the head.
You can't, and vice versa. So, no, it's a nice thing too, because you get a chance to meet people and relate to, you know, them in lots of different ways. But so, yeah, that was, you know, that was quite a blow. And what a bunch of music they left to us. Just amazing.
Well, how close are you and Bob in age?
We're about 3 years apart.
So I read you guys are from, you formed in Hoboken. Are you actually from that area, New Jersey, or where in Jersey?
No, we actually formed in Rutherford, New Jersey. It's a town we grew up in, and Rutherford's about 7 miles east of Hoboken. And we went to a little Catholic school called St. Mary's, and Bob was playing guitars with a friend of his, Matt Lemaire, and they had this little acoustic thing going, and I nosied my way in, and the three of us started playing, and then we just started. It's you know, our everything we've done musically in that way started through relationships and friends, and it just built out from there. that turned into like, hey, let's go play some places. And we got booked. And our first band was actually a bluegrass band. We jokingly say like what we thought was a bluegrass band because we were from New Jersey, but we had a banjo player. I decided at one point I wanted to learn how to play banjo. So I went and found probably the only banjo player in New Jersey and took lessons from him. And then he ended up becoming a friend and joined our band. And, you know, any song we did became a bluegrass song because, we had a banjo and a stand-up bass, a couple guitars, spoon player. And we played out a lot. It was a lot of fun. And that's where we really started to sing a lot. Mm-hmm. We had four people singing harmonies. We had three, four part harmonies. And that's really where we started singing.
We mentioned, you know, having this rock and roll class, but what got you into having sort of a bluegrass sound, as country sound? I mean, did you have any other siblings? Was there, what kind of music was going on in your household when you grew up? What directed you to more roots, folk sorts of things?
You know, I think naturally all of that music, for some reason, spoke to us looking back on it. You know, the birds, for some reason, just, you know, the jangle sound of the guitars and the harmonies, that sort of melodic, Searchers, Beatles, you know, birds, all of, that kind of music really kind of, I think, hit us in a way. But I would say that what pulled it, you know, what sort of pulled it around was in a way of actually researching and learning about a lot of different musicians was our friend Matt Lemaire, who I mentioned before, who played bass with us. He was a fan of, he had these old Hank Williams records. He had the Will the Circle Be Unbroken 3-set record, if you're familiar with that, with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And that had, you know, that had this, just every song that, you know, for, it was just like the sort of greatest hits, you know, encapsulation of these great songs from that. And, you know, it featured Earl Scruggs and on banjo and had all these greats on it. And that, we were introduced to that. And he also introduced it to John Prine and the storytelling from you know, the storytelling of John Prine and other people we were listening to at the time, you know, Bob Dylan and of course Bruce Springsteen, they all seemed like they felt, you know, in the same world. So we were kind of putting together the storytelling and the sort of jangly pop together, and those are sort of our favorite things, and that's just kind of what we learned to play guitars on, and that's what we learned to sing on, and that's what we learned to, you know, being in a group of friends and playing down somebody's basement or on a camping trip, or then we'd go to, you know, go into little clubs around North New Jersey and play.
Well, there's a band from New Jersey, the Insomniacs, we play here in the Underground Garage, and they feature a couple of brothers, Dave and Bob Wojciechowski.
Yeah.
And for the most part, they, you know, they always seem to get along pretty great. I mean, there's some brotherly stuff, but they've been doing their band for many years. Has your relationship with Bob changed over the years? I mean, you mentioned so early on you sort of got yourself in there with him and this other friend. But has your relationship changed over the years from when you guys started through when you were active in the 90s to when you went on, let's say, a hiatus until now? Has your relationship evolved in any sense?
You know, working with your brother or your sister or any sibling, I think, has got to be, it's a pretty unique situation. And I think we always got along well because our folks set us up to get along well. You know, they always told us early on that we were going to be our, you know, each other's best friend. And I think even at a young age, you kind of think about that. But that doesn't mean you don't go through the periods of time where I was just a little brother. And that particular situation, it was Matt Lemaire that asked me to play with them, not Bob. So, I mean, I'm talking about they're upstairs in the attic just playing through some songs. And they're like, hey, Mike, why don't you join us, you know? And it was a lot of fun. So, you know, I think if anything, I'd say that we've gotten, we've gotten a lot closer since those days. Because those days, we were, you know, sort of stuck into those roles of, you know, big brother, little brother. And, you know, we all had our separate group of friends. And as the years went on, you know, as far as being together, the two groups of friends kind of merged. A lot of our my friends from In fact, my friend who was their first drummer, Chris Mijos, we went to school as well, and he's more my age, and then he ended up being, so it was the two of us, and Matt and Bob were our first band. We had a band. We eventually moved from Rutherford to Hoboken because that's where all the clubs were. There was a great scene going on in the late 80s and early 90s. James Mastro from the Bongos helped me get my apartment. I mean, it's another very small, insulated little town, you know, but I lived right across the street from Maxwell's.
Oh, I was going to ask you how often you had played at Maxwell's, but yes.
Maxwell's was one of those places that they featured a lot of, national acts. So we played there probably, once or twice a year because that's the kind of place it was. But coming up when we first moved there, there's a little bar called the Elysian Cafe that's a block towards the water, a block away from Maxwell's, and it's still there. And the son of the owner had taken over the little bar, and it's just an amazing little, turn of the century bar. It's so ornate, beautiful. Like the ceilings are just the same. There's murals. It's been featured in a bunch of movies. It's this great looking little place. But he had this back room that was a storeroom, and the owner, Bob was in there having a beer one day, and the owner said, "I'm thinking about cleaning out that back room, and having bands back there. Would you guys be interested?" Because he knew we were playing. And we jumped at it because it was a place that we could play a lot. We needed to play a lot. We needed to be one of those bands that wanted to play all the time and get better. We playing once every 6 months wasn't going to make us any better. So we went in there, sometimes every 2 weeks, sometimes every 3 weeks, sometimes once a month. But it was just a great place to go in there and throw down three sets. And it's really where we sort of came up and learned how to play. That was a great time. That was during, I'd say, the late 80s through the early 90s.
So you form in Rutherford, you switch over, move over to Hoboken for a bit. Then you move down to Nashville. That's the timeline, right?
It is.
So the Nashville thing, somebody at BMI, Jody, someone's, who is it that encourages you to go to Nashville, and what does it take for you guys to realize, oh, hey, yeah, this is what we need to do?
Sure. Well, Jody Williams' name was at BMI, and we were playing at the New Music Seminar in New York City, and it was probably 87 or 88, and he heard us, and he said, you guys should come check out Nashville. And at the time, we were thinking, like, what, some things were happening in Nashville that were starting to, seemed really interesting to us. It was like this music like Steve Earle and, not that Emmylou Harris was starting, but you're hearing her more, different things she was doing. Nancy Griffith, who just passed away sadly, and Foster and Lloyd, and all these like singer-songwriters were coming out of Nashville as opposed to commercial country. And that sort of piqued our interest. And so Jody set us up on a week-long, visit to meet a bunch of different people, and we went to Nashville and met folks at publishers and just kind of made the rounds and met everybody and kind of just it was great. And we also, skipped over to Memphis and met the guys over at Ardent, and it was just a week long. It was a great week long sort of emergence into what was going on here. And we just fell in love with the town. We fell in love with the people that were, it's just a creative, warm place. And we felt like New York was a great place to play out live, but what we were doing just wasn't happening in the industry. So I told the story recently, we're walking down Music Row. We have this one appointment our first appointment is with a publisher. And there are these, and if you've been to Nashville, there are these, or it's more, they used to be this way, these little houses along the way, and each one's a little company. And we just walked in there and we sat down with the publisher, and we had a cassette tape, of course, and he played all four songs while we were sitting there. And I thought, this would never happen anywhere else. And then he said, these are great, get any more? And we're like, yeah. And then, so that became, that was just such a different experience for us. And again, while we played live, had a good following in New York, it was a lot of fun. The Nashville thing became, a situation, and that we felt like maybe we could, you know, maybe we could have a career here, or it, you know. And I think a lot of it was just lifestyle too, because both Bob and I went to art school in New York City, and so we had never kind of lived any other place. And so coming down here was a new experience. I think a lot of people go away for college and they try different things. And we, you know, we'd been on the road, different places up and down the Northeast, down to South by Southwest. And we traveled some, but for the most part, we hadn't ever lived any other place. So the Nashville thing felt eventually we were visiting here so often, you know, we just said, well, why don't we just move here for a while, see what happens, you know? And then I think we just, again, you know, made so many good friends here, great songwriting community, great musicians here, great clubs, people in the industry, everybody sort of hung out. It was a lot of fun. Everybody's trying to do, you know, do good work down here. And of course we met Gary Talent down here. A lot of people think we met him up in New Jersey, but yeah.
Oh, well, that was my next thing was to bring him in, and I'm surprised that it was down there. So you mentioned Gary, you know, producing the records, and we know he's the bass player in the East Street Band. So it wasn't in Jersey that you met Gary. It was in Nashville.
That's correct. It was that first week. We had a lot happened that first week.
It'll make a great montage for the movie.
It will. In fact, before I get to Gary, I'll tell you that the first night we went there, we drove down from Hoboken, just Bob and myself, and we drove into town, and we got there about 10 o'clock on a Monday night, and we thought, well, we should get a beer. And then I remember saying, we should just drive by the Mother Church, Ryman Auditorium, and you know, tip our hats. But then we thought, let's stop and get a beer. And we went into this one little bar on Broadway. Broadway was not like what it is now. You could actually park right on Broadway in front of a bar. And we went right into this little bar on Broadway, and we had a beer, and it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. But we, just the two of us, it was quiet. It was Monday night. We go to get back into our car, and Bob goes around the passenger side, and he sticks his head in the window of this little place called Tootsie's. And he looks in and he says, I think we should go in here for a beer because U2 is playing in here. And I said, okay. I mean, I don't remember. I think my jaw dropped. So we just kind of, you know, very sheepishly walked up to the front door and looked inside, and we thought, what is going on? I mean, this would never happen anywhere else. We stuck our heads in. There were 10 people. We thought something was going on, like private party, or they're filming something. And we stuck our heads in, and it was Bono and Adam Clayton Jr. and an older guy playing the steel, like mid-70s. The three of them are playing. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. So we walk into the bar. Again, there's about 10 people. We go to the bar, and we're just sitting there, and we eventually order a beer, realizing they weren't going to kick us out. And I just said to the bartender, I said, this is amazing. And he said, what? I said, these guys playing here. And he goes, you know, who are they? And I said, that's U2. And he said, are they big? And I said, have you heard of the Beatles? I mean, you know, it was like they didn't know who they were, you know. And this, nobody really knew who they were. They had a couple of friends that I think they had made, because they had filmed Rattle and Hum somewhat recently. And I think they made friends in Nashville and Memphis. And I think they just came down to visit. That's kind of what we came to understand, because he said, well, are you guys pickers? This is the bartender. And we said, yes. And he said, well, you're next. And so after they got done singing, Bob and I went up and did a couple songs, and it was just a surreal evening. Bono was dancing with someone in front of us. It was just one of those really, and we got a chance to meet them, and they were great, and they were just really nice. And we thought, if this is Nashville, I'm in, you know? Later on in the week was when we met Gary, and that was actually at a Steve Earle show.
So obviously you guys hit it off. How did he become involved in producing your records?
So he actually approached us, because apparently there weren't a lot of leather jackets in Nashville at the time. I can't believe that. But he walked up to us in the bar. We were wearing our leathers, and he said, you guys must be from New Jersey. You're wearing uniforms. And out of the blue, you know. But we had seen him, because he jumped up on stage and played a song with, we were massive Steve Earle fans. He was playing at a big club called The Cannery And Gary was up there, and and I think he'd worked with Steve on something, a couple things maybe, and co-wrote something or co-produced something. I don't really remember, but I think he, so he jumped up on stage and we saw him, and that's really great. But then he approached us, and then we just started talking, and he said, well, do you have any music? I'd love to hear it. And we thought, oh God, yeah. So we ran out to that same car and the trunk, and we had about a thousand cassettes in that trunk, and we brought one into him and gave it to him. And then we just kept in touch. We went back to New York, Hoboken, and we just kept in touch, just called here and there. We would send him some demos, and eventually when he was just in the process of moving here at the time, a couple times we talked, he was actually still at his studio, Shorefire, in Long Branch. So he was working there a bit, and then he was working here in Nashville. But we ended up coming down to do a demo. By that point, it was just, Bob and myself, and which was a really interesting thing, because we ended up, that first publisher I told you about, his name was Mike Porter. He was a drummer. He signed Jim Lauderdale as a songwriter. He played in Rodney and Roseanne's band. So he'd been a drummer for a long time, turned publisher. So the two of them actually became the rhythm section for our demos, which is really, really interesting. They became really good friends. Gary played bass, Mike played drums, and they co-produced it. And so the four of us went in and started working. And that became the beginning of the first record.
So now Gary produced, I know, the first album. He also produced the second album.
Yes.
And so you guys are getting back together. It just seemed natural to contact Gary.
Yeah, because we're, it's, again, Nashville's a small, it's a big, small town. Gary became a great family friend. I mean, we just hit it off in lots of different ways. He had young kids, our kids' age, and, they just became family. I mean, my kids still call him Uncle Gary there. So we were, we were close friends at the time, but it's just, going into the studio, getting this invitation to record at Blackbird. Of course, we called, Gary was there when we got the invitation, so.
Oh, well, let me back up for a moment. Why did you get this invitation?
So we were playing, there's a band down here called the Long Players, and it's Bill Lloyd, Steve Allen, a bunch of guys from Nashville, and they're called the Long Players, and they take a classic album and they learn it start to finish, and then they get guest artists to come up and do each song. And we've done it from time to time. It's a really fun night here at a club called Third and Lindsay. That's where they do it now. They sort of pack it out. It's a lot of fun. They were doing a Tom Petty album. So Bob and I got invited to do a couple songs, and Gary actually formed that band. But depending on when he's on the road or not, he doesn't. Another bass player, a guy named Brad Jones, plays when Gary's not playing. So Gary was there, and a friend of ours who introduced us to her husband, who manages Blackbird. And Blackbird has a thing called the Blackbird Academy, which is a school for engineering. And from time to time, they invite artists to come in to play. And, and they say, if you don't mind four or five students watching you, and, we were used to more than four or five people watching us in the recording studio. It's really great. And we came to find out that a lot of other musicians here in town make their records over at Blackbird that way. So Gary was there, and the manager, Rolf Zweep, his name was, he and his wife, CJ Hicks, they're just good friends. And he said, hey, you should come over to Blackbird and do one of our Academy sessions. And we said, okay, great. That sounds great. And then that became, Bob and I had been talking about doing a record for years, and we just, things just sort of got in the way. Both Bob and I do a lot of creative work, so we feel like we're in that world anyway, And we actually work together. He's a great photographer and designer, and I'm a designer as well. And we work together, so we're always sort of doing something together anyway. Anyway, we get this invitation, and it went great. And we called Gary, we called Brian Owings, the drummer, and we did a week and got seven songs down. And Rolf said, "Hey, you should come back, do another week." So we, about a month later, we came back and did another week, and so that gave us another seven songs. Then we had 14 songs, and then the pandemic hit. So,
all right. Well, let's talk some about this. Some of the tunes on here. The new album features our coolest song in the world this week. All in All is the opening track. did Bob write that, or who wrote the song?
Bob wrote that song. It's called All in All, and it was the first song that we tracked in that session. I think it was a good one to start with. We've talked about this since, because it was one of those where we hadn't played together. We'd played here and there, got up with people, you know. Bob's made three records on his own in the last couple of years, and so and I played on them and sang on them, but we hadn't formally gotten together. So, you know, it was just interesting to say, well, what's the first song we're going to do with these guys we haven't played with in a long time? And that one seemed like a good sort of quintessential song that we would do, melodic, you know, simple, straight ahead, jangly guitars, you know, a lot of vocals. And so, yeah, that was the first song.
Like, be sure and tell Bob I like the harmonica on there. Very nice touch.
I will.
That's also his playing on Short Bed Blues, the harmonica.
That's right. That's right. That's something he took up, I think, pretty early on, because a lot of the songs we loved, you know, had a harmonica in it. But, you know, especially when we played acoustic, just the two of us, because when we started playing, you know, without a band, we were still in Hoboken, we did a number of shows, just the two of us. And that sort of helped add another dimension to it. I would play electric and he would play acoustic, but he played the harmonica too. And he's, you know, he's just played over these years, gotten better and better. And it just, we really love that texture in there.
So a Short Bed's around 5'8". How tall are you guys? Well, I'm asking because, you know, is Short Bed Blues a thing that's like happened to either of you guys? Like, you know, you're stuck in the short bed and your feet are hanging off the end, like what, Abraham Lincoln or something?
Pretty much, yeah. this might be inspired by Bob has a 1970 something pickup truck. We're not on. And so, probably inspired
by the truck.
By that.
Yeah, of course. We're talking about Nashville here.
That's right. And he drove down to North Carolina to pick this truck up, and it's just absolutely incredibly beautiful. It's two-tone lime green. It's crazy looking. He's not like hauling anything around in it. You know, maybe a guitar or two in the back.
Well, here thematically, let's see if I'm right here or not. Or let me know. Light of your eyes. To me, that's sort of shares thematically with All in All, sort of a sense of love and being sort of overwhelming. There's drowning imagery. Light of your eyes. How was that one put together?
Love and drowning. that I think those two songs I think you've picked out are the two probably that Bob wrote about meeting his wife, I'm going to imagine. So the first one, you know, pulls out a lot of imagery of our youth, the Jersey Shore and the boardwalk, and you know, those we all lived in Hoboken at the time, and we would jump in the car on a Friday night and drive down to the Jersey Shore, where we would share. We would get 14 guys in a two-bedroom house in Bradley Beach, and we would. Not no exaggeration. And we spent summers there. And I think, you know, that's, you know, those are the times that right after college where we spent a lot of time down there and going to the Stone Pony and the Fast Lane and Brighton Bar and just going and see a lot of good music. And I think that's it's him looking back on the times where he spent in our youth and when he met his wife. And but I think he pulled out the two love songs.
Well, a lot of love on the album, Joy and Sorrows That Follow, but there's also a very unique love song on there, This Old House. So whose house is that song about?
Well, I think we both have, that's about one of Bob's house. We have this tendency to not buy anything new around here. We have every house.
You want something with character, right?
That's right. When we moved here, we both... moved into older houses, bought older houses. I moved into my first house was a little 1930s cottage, and then I moved to a 1906 Craftsman bungalow, and now I'm in a 1930s ranch. And Bob moved into, I'm going to say that this song he wrote is about his probably his second house. He bought a this huge four square that was built in, I think, 1904, right in the middle of town near Vanderbilt. It's just absolutely incredible. But it was owned by the original owners, built by the original owners, but it had just kind of fallen into disarray. And so he took on, you know, Bob is pretty crafty guy, and he can do pretty much anything that he wants to. But he, you know, he rewired the house himself. He basically took off like 6-7 months, and just, he did so much work to the house himself. And it was a beautiful house. They recently moved right down the block, but they had that house. That's where they raised their kids. It's a really beautiful house. But, you know, I think it's that love-hate relationship with older things, you know, but the character in them, I think, is just to be surrounded by that sort of history. I don't know. It's the same thing with cars and as well. I mean, my father and grandfather both worked for General Motors, and they would come home with these great old cars all the time. We were just always surrounded by that. My grandfather had a 1970 Coupe de Ville, and when he passed away, my father took it over it, and then eventually. He got a 64 Cadillac and gave me this 1970 Cadillac, and I drove that into the ground. But we've both had older cars, and just the character of that is just something that's always, you know, it's always appealed to us.
So when you guys were together back in the 90s, you had Benmont Tench from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers playing with you. Do you still keep in touch with him?
We do. Gary does more often than we do. We see each other on social media and say hello here and there. But we actually initially approached him to maybe play keyboards on this record, but that was right in the middle of the pandemic, and he wasn't set up in a studio where he could actually do it. This is when we were working on it. It was pretty locked down. I mean, there were no studios you could go into, and he didn't have a setup at the time. But we loved, you know, that's one of our favorite bands, and you know, Mike Campbell on guitar and Benmont on keyboards was just, you know, the textures that they provided those songs is just stuff that we really, really loved. And so we were very, very excited when he played on the first two records.
That's what I thought. Actually. So the album's been out a week now. You mentioned how your friends were really disappointed that you guys had not been being able to play out more, and then the pandemic hit. And are there any plans to tour?
I think we're just seeing how it goes. You know, we're sort of in the middle of some things happening and some things getting canceled. And, you know, I think we're playing a set at the Americana Fest. That's on the 25th. That's the only date we have set, but we're talking about doing some record release shows, and I think we'd like to do one here, and I think we'd like to be up northeast to do a few things, but we're just gonna play it by ear and see how it's looking.
Now the track I want us to go out on is The Junkmen, and it's off the new album Thousand Turns. Doesn't follow this sort of I guess it's almost as more of a roots in a pseudo sort of late 60s kind of bordering on psych rock kind of tune. When I ask you about this sort of sitar sound that's on there, where did the idea for the song come from? And is this another one of Bob's?
It is. This is one of Bob's too. You know, we have a couple of songs, I think, over the last two records that sort of go down this a bit of a psychedelic, you know, kind of, you know, jangly where, you know, for me, where the birds kind of went into 8 Miles High, there was some, like, you know, sort of psychedelic jangle, and it sort of comes from jamming a little bit, but we which we don't do a lot, but, you know, on the 12 string, it's just fun to kind of go off. But the particular guitar line started on a 12 string electric, but then we were doing some overdubs early on. We were doing some overdubs pre-pandemic, and we were over at Gary's house, and he has a studio, and he owns every toy in the world. And he had a...
I like that you referred to every instrument as a toy.
That's right. Well, sometimes they turn into the one.
Right.
It's so much fun. But he had the that little sitar guitar that I doubled the guitar lines on that, and that was that was a lot of fun to sort of play that. And then one of the other co-producers, a guy named Dave Coleman, who's a great musician and engineer here, he actually played a little alternate guitar line on there too, that's back there. But it was, I think, those guitars that are, you know, pretty manic were influenced by, I think, the subject matter, which was probably written in the thick of politics at the time.
I was wondering if there was a political bent to that. That seemed to be inherent. But when you were talking about y'all's love of older cars, I thought, oh, well, maybe it's a more straightforward thing.
No, I think the subject matter was pretty political. And then, but the, the guitars, I think, were just and the arrangements were trying to reflect that. And we had actually had a couple different arrangements of that one. We had a 6/8 time version of that was pretty interesting too. We ended up going with this one because it was just a little bit more, you know, all out, straightforward, but angry. And I love the lyrics to that song, and it's just a different a little bit of a different take on how we different kinds of songs that we like to do. And I think they're, some of our songs go from one end being, a little bit more on the psychedelic harder edge, down to the jangly on the other side, or acoustic, or a lot of vocals, harmonies. And in the middle, we also throw in, our country influences, like Come and Go and Short Bed Blues. That just sort of happens naturally, just by it's the way that we're writing, or the way that we get into the studio and try one thing to the next, because each of the process in the studio was, Bob had written most of the songs. We wrote three together, and then we come into the studio and we worked together on them, put some arrangements together, just the two of us, just some ideas. And then we went into the studio with the four of us, and we just sat down for 15, 20 minutes before each song, played it down for them. They charted it. And then we said, okay, let's go try it. And they're so great that they just walked into the studio and just, that's the way the record was made. Very relaxed, very just, and it was a pretty different process, I think, than a lot of other records, because it was just friends getting together and having some fun. And we didn't really have these huge expectations in the beginning. It wasn't like, this has to be this or this has to be that. This was the first record we did that there wasn't a record company. And I think it came through. I think it's really relaxed and really fun. And it wasn't until we kept going with it, they were like, this is sounding like a record, But I was going to say, just the styles kind of go from one to the other, because you do a certain song in the studio and then you think, well, let's do something different. And then you go from, slower, maybe it's the tempo changes because you want to change it up a little bit. Or you just kind of want to bring something fresh to it. And that's what I think feels like we've got different sounding songs that go through the album, but at the same time, I think there's these elements that sort of connect them all, either the vocals or the guitars or something.
I was wanting to wrap up right here, but I had a brain fart a moment ago, and all the time. Thankfully, we can't smell anything like that through the magical radio.
That's right.
You mentioned on the 25th, Saturday the 25th, tomorrow, that you're playing at some type of Americana festival. What did you say?
So in Nashville, they have a conference for Americana music.
Conference.
Yes, it's called the Americana Fest.
And so what we haven't really broached here is that when you guys were initially active with the first album, the second album, this, the whole idea of Americana as being this genre was really gaining traction, and you guys had a lot of notoriety about that. How did you feel about that? Did you feel like you were were people projecting stuff onto you, like you were now the standard bearers of this new genre, or you're certainly one of the early groups that was, pointed to as Americana as a genre was being thought of? How did you feel about all that?
Well, I think those names were starting to be thrown around. But at the time, what I was mostly excited about was this was a format that was going to be able to play all the heroes of what I would think at the time, before the term Americana came out, was roots music, singer-songwriter. All of our heroes finally had a home in radio. And you know, where else could you hear, you know, Steve Earle or Foster and Lloyd or Nancy Griffith, Emmylou Harris, just these, you know, there was AAA, and that started moving a different direction, and then it left this gap. And there were two guys that were very instrumental in this, Rob Bleetstein and John Grimson. I remember meeting them early on, and they I don't know the exact roles they played, but they had a lot to do with the beginnings of the Americana term, and there was an Americana chart. And so I was mostly excited about the fact that I could hear great music, but then it turned out to be a format that embraced us. And I mean, I think we were one of the first bands to debut artists to chart on the label and then go to number one. So that was great. That became a way, because we always knew that we were going to fall through the cracks. We always knew we weren't doing what was exactly on any radio format. We're excited about that. And looking back on that, it was a really great time. So, yes, I've heard those people, I've heard those, you know, the mentions of us being part of that, and that's very kind. But, you know, I really was more focused on, you know, hearing John Prine on the radio again, and that was great.
Mike, thank you so much again for chatting with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you for having me. It was great. Appreciate it.
Well, let's hear exactly what this junk man is up to. It's the Delavantes off their new album, 1,000 Turns, in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was some of Junkman from the Delavantes here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track is off their new album called 1,000 Turns, and it's out on Moon River Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Mike Delavante for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations, and thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time, join me when I'll be checking in with Jesse Mallon. His new album, Sad and Beautiful World, that's out now on Wicked Cool Records. And we'll find out all about it on our next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
It's been a long time. Been a long time. Been a long, lonely, 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 lonely time.
Some things are better when they rock. Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos. Play 24/7 with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pool, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Been a long time since you rock and rolled? Visit us in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida, or online at SeminoleHardRock.com.